This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 22 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we have Kenny Albert joining us. Kenny, who is like the Swiss Army knife of sports announcers, making a name for himself in the NFL, NHL, NBA, and Major League Baseball. We can also now add author to his list of accolades with Kenny launching his new, very aptly titled book, A Mic for All Seasons, this week. And Kenny, thanks so much for taking some time to come on the podcast today. But I have to say, I wasn't surprised at all when I saw that you wrote a book, but I was pretty surprised to actually see that this was your first book. How long was this in the works?
Well, Brandon, first of all, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on. It is my first book and very proud of the fact that I wrote it myself. No ghostwriter. Wanted it to be my own voice, my own stories. My family was a big help, my wife and kids, as far as remembering some of the anecdotes and helped me through the editing process. But really thought about it a while ago. Whenever I speak at sportscasting camps throughout the summer, visit with high school and college students, they all have great questions. And I wind up telling a lot of the similar stories when they ask me those questions. So early in the pandemic was when I really moved forward with it. I had heard from a book agent, Andrew Blauner, out of New York City about a decade ago via email. He got in touch with me and said, if you're ever thinking about writing a book, let me know. Perhaps I can make a connection with publishers. And that's exactly what he did. Made the connection with Triumph Books out of Chicago, and they were great throughout the entire process. And early in the pandemic, when I was home for 146 straight days with not a lot to do, started by writing an outline and portions of sample chapters. And then over the next 2.5 years, in hotel rooms, on airplanes, etc., at home, finished it up. It was due about a little over a year ago, the first manuscript into the publisher, September of 2022. And then since then, went through the editing process, making changes, corrections, adding some additional stories. So very excited. Received my first copies about a month ago. You might see the cover behind me here, and official publication as we speak is actually tomorrow. So could not be more excited.
Tomorrow, and that being Tuesday, October 10th. We're recording this on Monday, October 9th. How are you enjoying now the media tour of having to promote the book? Does it get tiring or monotonous having to talk about it and even having to talk about yourself so much?
Well, it's been terrific so far. Appreciate all of the folks that have had me on, including you here today. We've had a couple of events, a friends and family party, and then another event in Tenafly, New Jersey, a Q&A hosted by Tracy Wolfson last Monday night. So that was a lot of fun. And then actually, as we tape this tonight, first official book signing in Ridgeway, New Jersey at Bookends. And we have some other events planned along the way. So I do wind up telling a lot of the same stories, but it doesn't really get old. There are so many of them in the book. I just felt like through three decades calling so many different sports, I had a lot of stories that hopefully the readers would be interested in. And, you know, it's funny, Brandon, a couple of hundred people have the book already, friends, family, some media members, folks who have been at the various events. And I'm always excited to hear what they take out of it. And it seems like everyone picks out something different, whether it's a story about my early life. I was premature, born 3 months early, spent the first 2.5 months in an incubator at Lenox Hill Hospital in Manhattan. Story about how my parents first met at a Mets game at Shea Stadium. So if not for the Mets, I wouldn't be here. My father was hosting the Mets radio pre and post game show. My mother was 19 years old at the time in 1964, working as an usherette hostess. And he actually interviewed her on the radio, so a lot of people wouldn't know that story. And then anecdotes about calling hockey, football, baseball, basketball, some of the memorable games, calling 8 Olympics, 6 Winter Olympics, some travel tales, stories about the 200 50 plus analysts that I've worked with, stories about the pandemic and how we broadcasted games during that time period, a chapter on paying it forward, advice to young sports sportscasters. So it's really a compilation of everything that I just mentioned. And it's not only a book about sports. There's a lot of family. I go through, you know, some of the early jobs, 6, 8, 10 hour bus rides with a minor league hockey team, the Baltimore Skipjacks. So a little bit about hard work and dedication. So it's really a combination of everything that I just mentioned.
So I want to kind of start at the beginning of your career a bit. And obviously, if you want to be a professional sportscaster, being the son of Marv Albert, one of the best play-by-play voices in sports history, is not a bad start. But while being the son of Marv Albert undoubtedly opened some doors for you, did it also feel like you had added pressure when you were starting out?
I never felt added pressure. Maybe I should have, but it's not anything that really ever affected me. There were definitely some doors opened early as far as having a great teacher in the house and watching the preparation that he would go through and learning via osmosis. When I was old enough, I would start keeping stats for him at Rangers, Knicks, NFL games. So I had a front row seat to what takes place in the broadcast booth, the communication between the announcers and the production truck. The preparation was the number one thing that I learned about, but I would also observe the communication between the play-by-play announcer and the color analyst. So just learned so much during those years. And really the huge break when I was in 10th grade in high school out on Long Island, a local cable station, Cox Cable, showed up at my school to film a girls' basketball game. And I was there covering it for the school paper. And I was introduced to the producer, Roy Menton, and volunteered to announce the game. They had two cameras and a small production van, and that was it. So they clipped a microphone onto my shirt. I announced that game and then spoke to him after the game and was given the opportunity over the next 2.5 years to broadcast, I would say, between 75 and 100 high school games all over Long Island in every sport, basketball, baseball, football, hockey, soccer, lacrosse. So I felt like I had such a head start back then. Kids my age couldn't really get the opportunity until college. So Cox Cable was a huge break. And then broadcasted basketball games in school at NYU. Brought my tape recorder to hockey games around the New York area, Rangers, Devils, Islanders games. And the goal was really hockey on the radio, and was lucky enough to get hired by the Baltimore Skipjacks in 1990 as the radio broadcaster, but also to handle just about anything that was needed, sales, marketing, PR, go pick a player up at the airport. So went on to Washington and the Capitals for 3 years at Home Team Sports. So getting back to your original question, I felt like those 5 years in Baltimore and DC really allowed myself to establish my own identity away from my home area. So that was a big part of the development as well, just getting the reps, doing the games down in Baltimore and DC.
And I think that's really cool that you consider an opportunity in 10th grade to call high school basketball for free as your big break in such what has now turned into such a celebrated career. The fact that you look back at that as a big break, as opposed to just something that part of the grind that you were able to move past, but the fact that you look back on that as something that has helped to almost build your career is really cool.
Right. It was great experience just getting the reps, doing all the different sports. That's where I started to love the variety, which is carried over through all these years. I would bring friends along as color analysts as well. So it was a lot of fun, but terrific experience.
When did you decide that you wanted to be a sportscaster?
You might not believe me, but probably when I was 5 or 6, growing up around it, my parents gave me a tape recorder for my birthday. And I set up my bedroom like a radio or TV studio. I would call games off the television. So knew it from a young age. Did a lot of writing in high school and college for both the town paper and the school paper in high school. And then at NYU as well, also broadcasted men's and women's basketball on the radio. But really knew from a young age. And it's really all that I ever wanted to do.
Was there ever like a pinch me moment as a kid because of an event you were able to attend or a celebrity that you got to meet, or was it all just kind of normal being around it because you grew up as Marv Albert's son?
Well, it felt normal because I didn't know any different. I was so used to it. I would tag along to games and to the WNBC Channel 4 studios. He was doing the 6 and 11 o'clock sports. So I didn't know anything other than that. But yeah. As I write about in the book, there were several occasions where a pro athlete would come over to our house. And it started with Dr. J, Julius Erving, on a couple of occasions. Dave Jennings, the longtime punter with the Giants, a number of hockey players, Chico Resch, Dave Maloney, who's now my partner, heading into our 19th season on Rangers Radio. So those were some of the childhood memories that I have of pro athletes coming over to the house. But I really did become used to it because it was the norm. But then going to so many games at MSG and keeping stats once I was old enough to do that. Also, I had already been a pro broadcaster for 2 years at the time with the minor league team in Baltimore. But my last hurrah as a statistician, I was over in Barcelona with the Dream Team NBC. So had a front row seat to those games as well. So that's certainly a moment that stands out.
Just last month, Ian Eagle was on Richard Deitch's podcast and he said that it was fair game for people to question whether his son Noah Eagle's early success as a young broadcaster comes from nepotism. So I'll ask you, how have you or have you had to combat the narrative that nepotism has helped your career?
Well, I've known Ian for a long time. He's a good friend. I saw those comments. Noah's a tremendous young broadcaster, already doing great things. I never really worried about it because, you know, my philosophy is once you get hired, you have to then do the job well to keep the job.
Right.
And when Fox Sports started up in 1994, late in 93, Rupert Murdoch acquiring the rights to the NFC package away from CBS, who had it for over 35 years. The Fox management, David Hill, Ed Gorin, George Krieger, they decided to hire, obviously, the great Pat Summerall, John Madden tandem, and then Dick Stockton and Matt Millen, another terrific crew from CBS. And then they went with four young play-by-play broadcasters who did not have a lot of football experience, at least three of us. Kevin Harlan was a little bit older, and he had done Kansas City Chiefs radio. I was hired, Joe Buck, Tom Brenneman, and we were all sons of broadcasters. In Kevin's case, his father was president of the Green Bay Packers.
Right.
And, you know, very proud to say that 30 years later, I'm still at Fox. Joe's had a Hall of Fame career. Kevin's had a tremendous career with CBS and TNT after leaving Fox. Tom Brenneman was at Fox for 25 plus years. So you might have a little bit of a foot in the door when you first get hired, but if you can't do the job, they're not going to keep you. So I think we've all proven ourselves. Fox, again, in taking that chance, I was 26. Joe Buck was 25. Tom and Kevin were a couple of years older. But I think all of us, you know, as we referenced earlier, growing up around it, learning via osmosis, we right. had such a head start. We had great teachers in our households. And I compare it to the children of doctors and lawyers and folks in so many other professions who grow up around it. They learn about it. They see how it works. And you definitely have a head start as far as taking it in via osmosis in whatever profession it might be.
You mentioned joining Fox in 94, and you were part of that inaugural season of Fox covering the NFL. And now 30 years later, you're still a prominent NFL voice there. When you look around at Fox's NFL coverage today, is it more surprising to see the list of names that have departed or more surprising to see the list of names that are still there after 30 years?
Well, there have been a lot of great people that have come through over the 30 years. And you know, when I think back to that first year, we had our first Fox NFL seminar in Anaheim in the summer of 94, and the Fox Sports logo was projected onto the screen at the front of the room, and John Madden raised his hand in front of a couple of hundred people and said, "Why are we called Fox Sports? We only have one sport. We should be Fox Sport." Well, soon enough, Fox had the NHL rights the next year, and I was fortunate to be a part of that, and then baseball the year after that, and then through the years, horse racing, golf, college football, college basketball, soccer, and so much more. But, you know, that first year, Terry Bradshaw, Howie Long, they've been there right from the start, still there. in year 30. There have been some great announcers that have come through, both on the play-by-play and color side, and a terrific group now. So just so proud to be a part of it and can't believe it's 30 years. I feel like the first game was last week on 9/4/94. Ron Pitts and I called the Cardinals and Rams. It was Buddy Ryan's first game as Arizona Cardinals head coach. Jerome Bettis scored a touchdown in that game for the L.A. Rams. They wound up moving to St. Louis the next year, and now they're back in L.A., and I'll be out there for a game this Sunday, so it's come full circle.
Did Joe Buck and Troy Aikman leaving for ESPN last year send shockwaves through the people at Fox the same way it sent shockwaves through fans?
Well, I can't speak for anyone else, but it certainly shocked me, given how long they were both at Fox, Joe right from the start, and Troy over 20 years. They're a great team. Still enjoy watching them on Monday Night Football. But when anybody's at one place for that many years, whether it's a player, coach, or broadcaster, it is surprising when they move on to a different network, for sure.
Did seeing the sports world's reaction to Buck and Aikman last year, did it kind of put into perspective just how important broadcasters are in sports and entertainment?
Well, you know, TV and broadcasting has been such a big part of my life right from the start, and sports television to me is the best reality TV. I mean, just look at the games that I've worked the last 3 weeks, weeks 2 through 4. We had a 12-point comeback in the fourth quarter by Atlanta, a 17-point comeback, 18-point comeback by Green Bay to win, and then a 23-0 game, and the Colts come all the way back to force overtime. So, you know, you couldn't write a script with the way some of these games turn out. And the networks, the broadcasters are a big part of it, whether it's Al Michaels now on Amazon, the Sunday Night Crew on NBC, the Monday Night Crew with Joe and Troy, or the Sunday afternoon Fox and CBS crews. You know, I guess we've become part of Sundays for the fans, the viewers, for a long time. They've gotten used to hearing a lot of our voices, and we certainly try to entertain as well as give the nuts and bolts and describe what's going on the field to the best of our abilities.
Were you at all bothered, or would you have been interested to have the opportunity to replace Buck in the lead NFL booth for Fox, the job that ultimately went to Kevin Burkhardt? Like, is that something that you think about, or are you more just concerned about who your partner is and what games you're scheduled to call?
Oh, absolutely. I think any of us who do this for a living, you know, we all want to be on the top crews and work the biggest games, for sure. But Kevin and Greg do a great job. I have a tremendous crew with Jonathan Vilma, Shannon Spake, our producer, Fran Morrison, director, Brian Lilly. When I think back, you know, I've had so many different opportunities at Fox, starting from the ground up, working on the sixth and last crew on the depth chart my first year with Ron Pitts, and then worked our way up. And then the 8 years with Tony Siragusa and Darryl Johnston, we were on the number two crew behind Joe and Troy, had the opportunity to work 5 NFC divisional playoff games during those years, had 3 great seasons with Rondé Barber, now in my 4th year with Jonathan Vilma, who's done a tremendous job. Have had the opportunity to work 1 Super Bowl. It was the world feed, the international feed of Super Bowl 46. So obviously that would be the pinnacle, to work a Super Bowl on network television. Have had the opportunity to call 2 of the last 3 Stanley Cup finals, 1 on NBC, 1 on TNT, baseball playoffs for Fox, NBA playoffs for MSG. So enjoy everything I'm doing. The schedule comes together like a jigsaw puzzle, and there's some crazy travel at times. There's a lot of work and travel involved, the preparation, but love what I do each and every day, so I never feel like I'm going to work. But yes, getting back to the original question, those biggest events as broadcasters are certainly what you strive for.
So that, along that same line of thinking, how much of an honor was it to be named one of the lead NHL voices, taking over for Doc Emrick when he retired, and then moving to TNT when they landed the NHL rights a couple years ago, and continuing to call Stanley Cups for them?
Right. That was a huge honor. I've done hockey professionally now since 1990, the last 28 years on the radio side with the Rangers, and then over a decade with NBC, working with great crews there, and Doc Emrick, who I consider one of the greatest of all time, I refer to him as the Vince Scully of hockey, getting to work Olympics alongside Doc and NHL playoffs. Not that we were ever in the same place, but calling games, you know, often on the same night and conference final series at the same time. And then stepping in when he did retire, worked the Tampa Bay Montreal final in 2021. And then when we collectively as a group were hired by the NHL on TNT, Eddie Olczyk, Keith Jones, and I back in 2021. And we lost Jonesy. He's now the president of the Philadelphia Flyers, but a tremendous replacement in Brian Boucher, who we all worked with at NBC as well. TNT has done such an unbelievable job overall covering the sport over the last 2 years, bringing in the studio show with Liam McHugh, Paul Bissonnette, Wayne Gretzky, Henrik Lundqvist, Rick Tocchet the first year and a half, Anson Carter. There's just such synergy between the game crews and the pre and post intermission guys. And they travel with us in the playoffs to the conference final 2 years ago, to the Stanley Cup final last year. So couldn't be more excited about getting this season underway this week. And we called a tremendous final between Vegas and Florida. So many great memories from that series last June.
Is Charles Barkley's NHL fandom welcomed at TNT? Like when he chimes in on a studio show, do the regular hockey broadcasters roll their eyes, or do they enjoy Barkley's input?
Oh, they love it. I've gotten to spend some time. We all have, the TNT hockey crew around Charles. He actually was at two of the games during the Cup final in Florida and rode back to the hotel with us in a van. So there were five or six of us, and Charles was holding court, and he is a huge hockey fan.
Yeah.
He follows it. He watches it. When he played in Philadelphia and then in Phoenix, he would go to games. And about a month ago, we had a seminar down in Atlanta with all of the TNT announcers from the various sports, and Charles was front and center with the hockey group, and he's excited about the upcoming season. So we certainly welcome him tagging along, visiting with us, attending hockey games whenever he'd like.
Would you be interested in calling a game with him? Maybe if he was like a third voice, not just a lead analyst on
the game? That's a great idea. At first, I thought you meant basketball, but I guess you're talking about hockey.
Hockey, yes.
And I've done the Knicks 15 games or so a year for the last 15 years with Walt Clyde Frazier, who's, you know, along with Charles, one of the greatest players of all time. But having the opportunity to work a game with Charles would definitely be a lot of fun. But he really knows hockey. He knows the history, the strategy. He follows the current teams and players. He's close with John Cooper, the head coach of the Tampa Bay Lightning. He's close with Wayne Gretzky and Rick Tocchet. So that might be something we'll have to throw out there to the TNT executives.
Would you rather call a basketball game with him or a hockey game? Which do you think would be more entertaining?
Wow. I'll take either one, but it would certainly be interesting to see how he would do on a hockey broadcast. I think he would be terrific.
I imagine you've had some pretty interesting pregame meetings and conversations with athletes over the years. Who is the most entertaining athlete to interview or meet with, whether that was on or off the record, those conversations?
You know, the one that stands out, Brandon, is Brett Favre. Had so many meetings with him during his career. And, you know, the way it works in football, the networks usually go in on Friday and watch practice and sit down with four or five players and coaches from the home team. You do the same thing with the visiting team Saturday when they arrive in the city. And Favre never gave the impression that he wanted to be anywhere else. You know, sometimes guys are rushed, have to get home to family or head to a meeting or some other event. But he would sit there with us for 45 minutes and just tell stories about hunting and fishing and his family and obviously the football stuff as well, but just a down-to-earth regular guy. Always enjoyed, you know, whether it was Peyton Manning, Eli Manning, Aaron Rodgers, always so cordial and kind with their time. Just last year, we had a Tampa Bay game in Cleveland, and Tom Brady sat there with us for about a half an hour. And it was a casual conversation talking about his team, his career. I tried to stump him. It was his, if I remember correctly, seventh or eighth start against Cleveland in his career against a different starting quarterback every game for the Browns. And he actually named five or six of them. So that was pretty impressive.
In meeting with Brady, did you ever think of him as somebody that would translate well to the booth with him planning on joining Fox next season?
Well, he had already signed, so we did make a reference to that with him. You know, I think he'll be terrific. I think whether it's Peyton Eli, I love watching the Manning cast. They're just so cerebral, study the game for many, many years. Matt Ryan, you know, I watched his game on CBS yesterday. Thought he did a terrific job with Andrew Catalan and Tiki Barber. Caught the second half on the plane. I remember the first time meeting with Matt Ryan his rookie year. I said to myself, this guy is going to be an analyst. You could just tell. So I called the shot on that one. Unfortunately, he's working for the rival network, but he's doing a terrific job.
Wayne Gretzky wrote the foreword for your book. Is he somebody you foresaw having a media role in retirement? And how do you think that Gretzky has done as a studio analyst for the NHL on TNT?
Well, he could do anything he wants, you know, with his brain, his knowledge, his reputation. He's another one. I mentioned Favre during Gretzky's playing career, was just so cordial to the media, to the fans. Wayne, along with Walt Clyde Frazier, who wrote my other forward, this is hard to fathom, but in my opinion, they're both better people than they were athletes. And Wayne was the best in his sport ever, and Clyde was one of the best in his sport. But I've never seen either of them turn down an autograph request, a photo request, etc. But as far as Wayne on television, he's done a terrific job. He was with us during an outdoor game in Hamilton in the booth, along with me and Eddie 2 years ago. And then it's like the old E.F. Hutton commercials. When E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. When Wayne Gretzky talks, especially about hockey,
yeah,
I'm all ears. He has a photographic memory, a recall for games that he played in and was a part in, similar to what Peyton Manning can do. And there's just such an institutional knowledge of the game. He's universally liked by everybody. And when he's in that studio, he's not there all the time during the regular season. He was there for most of the playoffs and the entire Stanley Cup final. But, you know, having a Wayne Gretzky and a Henrik Lundqvist together, for example, along with Liam and Anson and Biz, when those guys talk about their experiences, about what they're seeing on the ice, you know, it's second to none as far as, you know, I think the NBA, Inside the NBA on Turner, the Fox NFL Sunday, probably the two greatest pregame shows of all time. But the cast, the group that the NHL on TNT has put together is right up there.
In your book, A Mic for All Seasons, you mentioned your relationship with Barry Trotz, who, interestingly, you roomed with very early in your career. But maybe even more interesting is the fact that your friendship survived a sort of arrest prank from Barry.
Yes, it did. Actually received a text from Barry last night. I sent him the book. He just received it. So I'm sure he'll be interested to read about some of those anecdotes from 30 plus years ago. Again, my first job, Baltimore Skipjacks, American Hockey League. I was 22 years old. Barry was 26 or 27. He was hired as the assistant coach. And at that level, to save money, the front office sometimes would pair the broadcaster and the bus driver together on the road as roommates. But in our case, it was the radio guy and the assistant coach. So Barry and I roomed together for 2 seasons in cities such as Utica, New York, and Binghamton, New Haven, Connecticut, Portland, Maine, Springfield, Massachusetts. And he was the best. It taught me so much about hockey, about life in general, life on the road. And I taped an interview with Barry, as I would often do before many of the games. And on this particular night, something he said came out funny. It came out wrong. I can't remember exactly what it was. I didn't use it on the air, but the mistake I made was going to play this cassette tape for some of the players. And word got back to Barry that I was kind of making fun of whatever it was that he said. And he told me, I'll get you back one of these days. So 4 months later, you know, I forgot about it. We fly up to the Maritimes in Canada. It's the only time we flew all year. And it was 3 flights in one day, Baltimore to Boston, Boston to Halifax, Halifax to Sydney, Nova Scotia. And we had been told that because we were traveling on a regional jet, the hockey equipment, the big hockey bags and the sticks would be the priority. And that a lot of our personal luggage would not make it until the next day. So we get off the plane in Sydney, on the steps down to the tarmac, small airport, and there's a gentleman at the bottom with a clipboard, points to my name. Is this you? Yes, please come with me. They bring me into a small room. 2 gentlemen start interrogating me, and then they transferred me to an unmarked car, and they start driving around, and I have no idea what's going on. And the questions are, is your passport valid? Have you ever been arrested? Have you ever done anything illegal? Anybody you know in trouble? Did you have anything illegal in your luggage? And I know that the answer to all these questions is no, but I have no idea what's going on. Finally, about 15 minutes later, they pull up to what looks like a hotel. And they said, we have one last question for you. Do you know Jim Wiseman? And Jim was the security chief for the Capitals and the Skipjacks. We all knew him. It turns out his brother was the police chief up in Sydney, Nova Scotia. So this was a whole prank set up by Barry Trotz and Jim Wiseman. They got one person every year, a rookie, someone new to the organization, whether it was a player, a trainer, in my case, the radio broadcaster. So that was a prank, fake arrest that Barry set up in 1991 or 92. And he's still talking about it all these years later.
How long did you wait before ever making fun of Barry Trotz again?
Yeah, that probably didn't happen after that.
How is working with Tony Siragusa for so many years, the late Tony Siragusa?
So many stories. He was the best. The late, great Tony Siragusa worked with Goose and Moose, Darryl Johnston, for 8 years. Never a dull moment on or off the air. Tony was terrific as, he referred to himself, a sideline analyst. He hated being called a sideline reporter. His mic was open at all times, and he saw things. He studied film through the years, and he could tell by the direction of a lineman's finger on the turf, whether it was going to be a run play or a pass play. And he would point a lot of these things out on TV. He usually saw things that we didn't. Off the field, off the air, he was not a guy who wanted to be sitting in his hotel room doing nothing. Always had to be on the move, live life to his fullest. And I've done 6 or 8 things in my life once that were with Tony. He was the camp counselor. He would lead the group activities, whether it was going on a swamp boat tour in Louisiana when we had a Saints game and petting baby alligators, getting soaked by Shamu at SeaWorld in San Diego. And it's on video. Tony and I sitting right there up against the cage, up against the tank, taking a jet boat ride in Niagara Falls when we had a Bills game. The only time I've ever held or shot a gun at a range in Dallas with Tony. So many more great memories. We lost him way too early last year. But when I think back, he certainly did live life to its fullest. And I probably have more stories about Tony than any of the other 200 plus color analysts that I've worked with.
Because he had that, he was down on the sideline and he had that free reign to chime in whenever his mic was always open. Did he ever have an accidental hot mic moment?
You know, ironically, I don't think he ever did. I don't really recall.
It's pretty impressive.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
His mic was open. He controlled it the whole time. And I was always amazed at the fact that Moose and Goose never really stepped on each other, which is broadcast parlance for speaking over each other. I would call the play, recap the play, and then get out of the way so that Moose can come in. And then every 3 or 4 plays, Goose would add something as well. And it was unique. It was a lot of fun. It was 8 years that I think about often. And we worked some great games, 5 NFC divisional playoff games. We had Favre's last win with the Packers in the snow against Seattle, the snow globe game. We had the great New Orleans-San Francisco playoff game in January 2012, 4 touchdowns in the last 4 minutes with Drew Brees and Alex Smith going back and forth. So just a ton of great memories. We worked a Pro Bowl together back in January of 2008. Terrific times. Love Moose. We were together for 10 years, 8 with Goose, and it's a time period that I'll never forget.
I think you've worked with Troy Aikman in your career. I know you've worked with the late Tim McCarver. What is that like working with a renowned analyst who's used to working with a different play-by-play voice? And now you're stepping in and trying to almost build chemistry on the fly.
Right. I did work with both. Worked 3 games with Troy in 2007 when Joe was off doing the World Series. And he was tremendous. Loved working with him. Such a hard worker as he was as a player, and really enjoyed those 3 games. Worked about 30 to 40 games with Tim McCarver, in my mind, the greatest baseball analyst of all time. He was probably the analyst I was most nervous heading into the game because I had watched him for so many years in New York and on national broadcasts. And I felt working with Tim, we became great friends you know, as we moved along and worked games together over the course of many years. And I was lucky enough to get to the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown when he was inducted, the Ford Frick Award winner. But he was a first guesser. He would see things before they happened. And it was an amazing ability that he had. But I just felt like I always had to be on my toes, even more so working with Tim than with anybody else. Have worked with, I think, 15 Hall of Famers on the football side. I've done games with Joe Namath and a number of other Hall of Famers. Worked a Sugar Bowl with Howie Long and Terry Bradshaw, Notre Dame LSU, which is one of my top memories from Fox. And then in hockey, there have been so many great analysts through the years. John Davidson, Eddie Olczyk, Pierre McGuire, Brian Boucher, Keith Jones, Joe Micheletti, Dave Maloney with the Rangers, right on down the line. So real lucky to work with all the analysts that I've been paired together with, whether it's been for 15 plus years, in Dave Maloney's case, 19 years, or many of the analysts that I've worked one game with.
How is that working with Terry Bradshaw for a game? Just again, another broadcaster who you're almost never sure what he's going to say next, always being entertaining.
Yeah, it was so great. It was the Sugar Bowl, Notre Dame, LSU, Jamarcus Russell and Brady Quinn. And it was close at halftime, turned into a blowout. But we spent a lot of time together in the weeks leading up to that game because Terry hadn't done a game in a long time since his CBS days. Howie had never done a game. He had never been in a broadcast booth. So we did some rehearsals in empty stadiums, calling games off monitors. And Howie, we had to teach him how to use the cough button, the talk back button, because he's used to being in a studio. Terry hadn't done a game in a long time, but they were tremendous. We went to meetings with the teams, the players, the coaches, and they picked up on it so quick and became experts on the two teams and had so much fun together that night. And I had such a good feeling following that game that I never went back to watch it. I wanted to remember it as it was live that night down in New Orleans.
Is there an analyst that you never worked with, but would like to, or would have liked to, like sort of a dream broadcast pairing for you in any sport?
That's a good question. I mean, John Madden would have been the ultimate. That would have been fun. I got to know him through the years as colleagues at Fox, but never worked a game with him. But whether it was Troy or JD or Eddie or Clyde or Tim McCarver, I've been real lucky to work with the top analysts in so many of the different sports. There's a list in my book of the 225 plus analysts that I've worked with. I might hold the record, and hopefully I didn't forget anybody, but a lot of great names on there.
Was working for the Knicks and Rangers ever difficult after your dad had a sort of falling out with James Dolan?
No. I mean, I grew up loving going to Madison Square Garden and going to games of both teams. And I started working there in 1995, calling Rangers radio, and have been treated great. I've met Mr. Dolan on a number of occasions, and the way that he treats the teams, the organizations. I've been traveling with the Rangers for 28 years, with the Knicks for about 15, and the way he treats the clubs is top-notch, the broadcasters as well, whether it's the flights, the hotels, you know, some of the amenities. Have loved each and every second of working for Madison Square Garden over the last 28 years.
Did it bother you at all that the Garden didn't acknowledge your dad's final broadcast there when he was retiring from the industry in 2021?
You know, he had such a great long run at the Garden. He's in their Walk of Fame when you walk up towards the ticket windows. Some of his greatest memories are working Knicks games and Rangers games. He called the 1970 and 73 Knicks championships. He called the Rangers winning the Cup in 94. So those are the memories that stand out when I hear those calls, when I think back to some of his great calls throughout his career. And we were both there in 94 for the Stanley Cup final. He was working on the Rangers side on radio. I was calling the game for NHL radio. So, you know, thinking back to the early days, I first started attending games at the Garden in the early 70s. So, so many great memories, and can't wait to get started with the Rangers home opener next Monday.
Do you think your dad would ever have interest in coming out of retirement to call a pro sporting event, even just as a one-off again? Like, does he have that itch to get behind the mic?
You know, he seems really happy in retirement.
Yeah.
I never thought he would retire, but he did 2 years ago. He's still involved in some projects here and there. and he enjoys watching games, still watching every game, every TV show, every movie. So I'm not sure at this point he'd want to call another game. You know, he wrapped it up with the NBA playoffs a couple of years ago, but he's still paying attention to everything. And, you know, he still reads as much as he did when he was working. And like I said, watching games, watching TV, watching movies. So not sure we'll see him call another game, but he's involved in some sports related projects still, even in retirement.
Have you surpassed your dad in frequent flyer miles?
That's a good question. You know, maybe I will someday. He spent, 50 plus years traveling on the road. My schedule is pretty hectic between the four different sports. So we haven't matched up the frequent flyer accounts just yet, but that could be a project for the future too.
Yeah. I know you talk about some travel stories in your book. Calling games in four major sports certainly makes for what has got to be a grueling schedule. What is the closest you ever came to missing or being late for a broadcast?
Knock on wood, it really hasn't come close.
Wow.
Did have to miss one broadcast due to a sore throat back in the late 90s, a hockey game in Washington, but that was the only one. Now, I do miss some games schedule-wise, you know, that are set in stone at the start of the season.
Right.
I don't do every Rangers game due to the other assignments, football on Sundays, NHL on TNT on Wednesdays. So there are some that I would be scheduled to do, but I'm taken off. But as far as missing a game, you know, we've had some crazy travel trips, you know, due to cancellations or weather. I've taken six-hour car rides on occasion, Buffalo back to New Jersey, or one time Atlanta to New Orleans. Frequent car trips between New York and Boston or Washington, just to get somewhere the night before. But, again, fortunately have never even come close to missing a game that I was scheduled to be at, aside from the one, when I had the sore throat.
Does all the travel make it harder or easier to prepare for a broadcast? Because obviously maybe it's not an ideal setting to prepare, but at the same time, you probably have a lot less, You have time where whether you're sitting on a plane or a bus or in a car, where you don't really have much else that you can do. So it's something that you can focus on preparing for a broadcast during those times.
No, it makes it easier. I actually feel like I get more done on the road, on the planes, in taxis, Ubers, in hotel rooms. You know, at home, you're running around, picking up dry cleaning, doing this and that. So some of those crazy times with three sports in a span of 4 days or four sports in a week or 10 days, to me, you know, you have to be organized, get ahead of it as far as the prep and the work. But I actually feel like I get a lot more done when I am on the road.
Yeah. What was that like in 2009? It was famously four sports in 4 days. What was that preparation like?
You know, like I said, just you have to be prepared, organized, get ahead of it. That stretch involved a hockey game, a basketball game, a football game. And then I was the sideline reporter and post-game interviewer following the Yankees Angels ALCS. So I wasn't doing play-by-play for that one, but you still have to be up to speed.
Sure. And
I have a checklist that I go through before every game. It involves a lot of reading, watching other games, preparing charts, pouring through statistics and other information, talking to players and coaches, going to press conferences. So as long as I check off all the boxes on that checklist, I feel like I'm prepared for whatever broadcast it might be.
Do you take a lot of pride in the ability to call games for the NHL, NFL, NBA, and Major League Baseball at a high level, especially considering like that's something that not many announcers are able to say they've done, and you're doing it on a regular basis for so long?
Yeah, I do. I love the variety and always have, you know, dating back to the high school days with Cox Cable, working so many different sports. And again, my goal was hockey on the radio, and that's what I started out doing with the Skipjacks. And then, again, Rupert Murdoch makes this crazy bid, and all of a sudden, a number of us are doing NFL games, which we never imagined, especially at that age. And, you know, added baseball and basketball to the mix as well. So, love the variety. Very fortunate that the networks that I work for have the multiple sports. And, you know, whether it's boxing or track and field, volleyball at the Olympics, some of the other sports that I've done, I enjoy those challenges as well.
Yeah, you even you did track and field at the 2016 Olympics. Like, are you secretly a track and field mogul? Is that something you knew much about before those summer games, or was it a bit of a crash course to learn?
It was definitely a crash course. Followed it a little bit, would watch it during the Olympics, but didn't really know the nuts and bolts. So for both track and field and volleyball, I went out and bought track and field for dummies, volleyball for dummies, true story. Talked to a lot of people who were involved in those sports, watched previous events. And in the case of the volleyball, sat down with our local volleyball coach at the high school here, the school my kids attended. And I said to her, please fill me in on the history, the rules, the lingo, the strategy. And it was a great 90-minute session, learned so much. And I think that's how you have to do it. You know, if it's a sport you're not as familiar with, you have to immerse yourself in it and learn as much as you can.
Out of college, you're kind of instilled with this desire to take every broadcast opportunity that comes your way. But at this stage of your career, do you look to cut back at all? Like the fact that you're still doing the four major sports?
Yeah, not necessarily looking to cut back yet. I'm sure at some point that might be the case, but love what I'm doing each and every day. And to have the opportunity to call NFL games every Sunday, NHL games on the national level and local with the Rangers. And I really enjoy calling basketball and baseball as well. So, you know, love everything that I do. And, you know, maybe there'll be a second book out there to write one day.
Is there ever a fear of making mistakes because you have so much airtime and know, especially now that so many people are watching you and examining everything that you say on a broadcast?
Not really a fear. You know, I have to remind myself sometimes, you know, in football, you have the Carolina Panthers. In hockey, you have the Carolina Hurricanes and the Florida Panthers. So you don't want to mix those up. In football, you have the play clock, and basketball is the shot clock. So little reminders along the way.
Quarters and periods. Is that ever that one that you got to be careful of as well?
NFL, NHL.
Yeah.
So, you know, definitely have to give myself reminders at times.
Is there a broadcast or a specific call that sticks out in your mind as one that you'd like to have a do-over with?
No, I wouldn't say a do-over. I thought you were going in the other direction.
That's going to be the next question. So we could jump. We could.
I mean, obviously, you know, you always strive to be perfect. You're never going to have the perfect broadcast, so you might want a call back here and there. But overall, I wouldn't say there's one full broadcast.
Considering how long you've been doing it, I think that's pretty good. Even Mike Breen last year had commented that he had a playoff call that he would have liked to have back that like right. Sticks out. I mean,
hockey now has become so quick and so fast. And, you know, there are a number of goals every game, not necessarily every game, but all the time scored on deflections. So you don't always see, you know, you want your goal calls to be smooth and clear. Fortunately, in the Stanley Cup final, there weren't many of those. Most of them were clear as far as who the goal scorer was, but it does get tough sometimes, you know, seeing who exactly got a stick on the puck.
So then now in the other direction, what sticks out in your mind as most memorable? And I'll start off with a few of my own, the Jose Bautista bat flip in the 2015 MLB playoffs. And I'm sure you probably hear that a lot from fans. It was the call was simple. You gave Harold Reynolds room, but best of all, I think you gave the crowd room in that call. Also, the Victor Cruz 99-yard touchdown, which broke my heart as a Jets fan. And then the other thing that sticks out to me is the Mets Cardinals, the 20-inning game from 2010.
Never left the booth to go to the bathroom in that one. I think Tim McCarver went once, nearly seven hours, never left the booth during that 20-inning game. Those are some of the ones on my end as well. Even though I've done less baseball than the other sports, the Bautista game, the home run and bat flip is one that I get asked about all the time. You mentioned the Victor Cruz 99-yard touchdown. The U.S. women winning the gold medal in hockey in Pyeongchang in a shootout, beating Canada in 2018. That one's up there. The Sugar Bowl that I talked about with Harry and Terry. The 1994 Stanley Cup, calling that for NHL radio, and then the two series on the TV side. I chronicle a number of other games in the book and key moments as well. On the football side, I've had so many. The Terrell Owens stomping on the Cowboys star, called that game. the only 8-5 final score in NFL history. One that I referenced yesterday on the Giants-Dolphins game when there was a potential 12-man in the field penalty. I called the game in 95 when Bill Cowher shoved the Polaroid photo in the shirt pocket of the referee Gordon McCarter to prove that the Steelers did not have 12 men on the field on a particular play. So, again, so fortunate to be involved in so many different sports, but those games that you mentioned and the few that I had are certainly the ones that stand out at the top of the list. I had the Michael Vick 46-yard overtime run early in his career in Minnesota, zigzagging his way up the field and then going straight through the tunnel. And then just last year, the crazy ending, the Raiders and Patriots, the laterals, Chandler right. Jones reception to bring it back for a game-winning touchdown for Las Vegas.
You mentioned not having to or not using the bathroom during the Mets Cardinals 20-inning game for 7 hours. A few years ago, Joe Buck actually said that he was using a bottle to go to the bathroom while calling a Brett Favre touchdown. And I think that was at Milwaukee County Stadium because he complained that the bathroom was too far from the booth to make it there during a commercial break. So have you ever had anything like that happen to you?
I've never done that. In hockey, football, and basketball, you know that you're going to have halftime between periods. Baseball, it's challenging because you only have a minute and a half or 2 minute commercial break if you're the play-by-play announcer between innings. The one story that I talk about in my book, Montreal, great hot dogs in the press room. And before a game back in the early 2000s, had two of these hot dogs. And with about 7 minutes left in the game, I felt my stomach start to churn. Fortunately, I was able to make it towards the end. That's probably the closest I've come to having to leave the booth during a game.
Let's say I'd consider yourself lucky then that you haven't had to stand there peeing in a bottle the way Joe Buck did. Yeah, no, it's all good. Kenny, you were great. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I really appreciate it. And best of luck with the book, A Mike for All Seasons.
Thanks, Brandon. Really appreciate it.
That is Kenny Albert. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing Podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.